right, here we go. Should be it for that one. Okay.
That's enough of the xylophone.
Yeah. Yeah, they really played.
I do like it, though.
They really played that one up. But all right.
Save that in the keepers.
So, yeah. It's the Grim Articles Show. Got Dead Penetration here.
What's up?
And we're going to talk about a bunch of different shit. So let's go ahead and change it real quick to the regular old things that we have here. And we're going to go ahead and...
You know what that sounds like? Intro to African Child? You'll have to say get them to the Greek. You'll understand. It's hilarious.
Grab that orange can and spray it.
What in the fuck is it?
The orange can right there. Oh. Seventh generation. Just spray it out. Here, hand it to me. I'll spray it. We're good. Oh. Yeah.
A little extra something if that's what it is.
It might be, but we got it under control. All right, so.
Sneaky sneakers.
Yeah, could happen sometimes. Uh-huh. Okay, so.
Let's go.
Damn.
What? Did you just mace yourself in the face?
I didn't mean to. I was spraying some air freshener and I got it.
All
right, guys. But yeah, let's get back to the professional part of this unprofessional.
Carolina Reaper flavor.
No, not quite. But all right. So what you guys notice is they're remaking American Psycho. Why? Because they're fucking idiots.
Running out of ideas. I hope they don't ruin the first one.
But they can't ruin the first one. It's already made.
Joker. They were basically ruined where the story could have gone with the first.
Oh yeah, I know. Lands.
With the second one.
Lands Luca Guadagnino as director. The film will serve as a direct adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis' novel.
Well, that,
so, this is a little different. Luca, whatever that guy's name is, has signed on to direct a new film adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis' novel American Psycho for Lionsgate. According to Deadline, the film will be a direct... Well, excuse me.
Music down. down.
Will be an adaptation of Ellis's novel and not a remake of Mary Harron's 2000 film starring Christian Bale. The book strikes a much darker and more violent tone than the film and spends more time inside the twisted mind of its character, Patrick Bateman. He's coming off the success of the tennis drama Challengers, which I didn't even bother with, while his upcoming film, an adaptation of William S. Burroughs' Queer, is earning plenty of buzz on the awards circuit. Queer.
I think
maybe the title turned
the
me
title
off.
The title kind of... I don't know. I usually think, butt sex? I mean, girl butt sex? Yes. I might watch that show. Maybe 2 or 3 episodes. Queer? I don't even think I want to... try to watch one episode.
Oh yeah, Jerry Cantrell's record came out.
Cantrell.
Yeah, it's called I Want Blood.
Oh, okay.
That's what he wants. He wants blood.
I wonder if it has that Alice in Chains.
I don't know yet. We'll have to look at it. Alright, so... there we go.
It's all about the war. You know, most of them songs are about war, Vietnam, and different things. Yeah, we come to stop Rooster. Yeah.
Okay. Adolf Hitler had some good ideas, a fifth of Gen Z Americans believe, according to Daily Mail poll.
Grim Lord thinks Hitler had good ideas.
I don't think that, but Adolf Hitler's reign of terror led to the murder of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust in the darkest moments of history. Well, in history, rather.
I bet you're with Palestine, too, aren't you?
There is little debate the Nazi dictator is one of the most evil men to have ever lived, with unprecedented depravity against people he didn't think worthy of living under the Third Reich. Around 85 million people were killed during the Second World War, a devastating and bloody conflict sparked by his relentless pursuit of a global empire. Yet, 79 years after he killed himself in a Berlin bunker, some people say he went to...
Argentina.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been some pretty interesting evidence.
More than 1 in 10, 11% of Americans, 11%! That's not that many. Nope. Believe that the barbaric German tyrant leader had some good ideas. A Daily Mail / JL Partners poll found that more than 1 in 5, 21% of both Gen Z and black voters,
whoa,
and 19% of Hispanic voters agreed with the statement.
Maybe black voters should look into some of the shit Hitler said about black people.
The survey asked 1,000. I know. The survey asked 1,000 likely voters whether they think Hitler had some good ideas or if he was evil and had no redeeming features. 77% said he was evil. 12 said they weren't sure, and 11% believe he had some redeeming qualities. When broken down by age group, 21% of those under the age of 29 said he had good ideas, compared with 16% of those between the ages of 30 and 49, 7% for voters between 50 and 64, and just 5% for those over 65. 14% of Donald Trump supporters said Hitler had some positive aspects, compared to 9% of Kamala Harris. If you need an example of the corrosive impact that social media can have on younger Americans' view of the world, this is it, said James Johnson, founder of JL Partners. The poll results seem part of a startling trend, with Gen Z becoming more sympathetic towards some of history's most evil individuals. Earlier this month, TikTok was forced to remove AI-generated and translated videos of Hitler's speeches that had racked up more than 1 million views. In one heavily edited clip, Hitler suggested he didn't want the Second World War and essentially attacked when he had no choice. While the cause of the conflict has been a focus of discussion for decades, it was Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 that prompted Great Britain and France to declare war on Germany. The TikTok clip is also translated in a way to suggest the Führer wanted to protect the lives of women and children. In reality, 1.5 million Jewish children were killed in the Holocaust, tens of thousands of Romani Gypsy children, and up to 7,000 German youngsters with physical and mental disabilities were also among the murders. Yes. A comment on one video that racked up 270,000 views read, "AH was a good and kind man. This changed my views on him." One account with 20,000 followers found by Media Matters had 4 million views of 12 videos of Hitler's speeches. Growing up is realizing who the villain really was. Text around an outline of Hitler reads on one of the posts.
And we've gone over this before. You know, basically, he'd come from World War One. He was a carrier, mail carrier in World War One, and he had been involved in some of the mustard gas attacks, so he had nerve damage from that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he had different ailments from World War One. And basically, they were having to give all their money to other countries because they lost the first war, and their German soldiers weren't being taken care of like they were supposed to.
Right.
And so he ran on nationalism and, you know, our soldiers haven't been treated right. They've been treated unfairly. They
sure.
died for our country. They fought for our country and nothing. So it kind of started out as a noble, but, you know, as he assumed power, all that shit went out the window. But we've already had 4 years of Trump, and we know he's everything they say he's like that holds no water, because we don't have a third right. He's already
right.
been president 4 years.
Right.
We've had more of it through a Democratic leader than we have Republican. And you want to look at anything, look at Joe Biden's speech where he had the background drop red and he was
calling
out.
Yeah, I remember that.
He was calling all people that supported Trump evil and, what was it? An enemy of the country?
Yeah. So we got the numbers here. Let's see. Hispanic and Black, man, they're all for it.
Yeah. Anybody that wants power would probably follow Hitler's first part. Once he declared war on the U.S., that was it.
Right. Okay, so let's see.
The Polish, they held their own too.
Okay, there's a better alternative to video game difficulty settings, but nobody uses it. Difficulty settings in games aren't always perfect, and many games still struggle to provide options that aren't too easy or too difficult. While some games like Elden Ring and Monster Hunter Rise forego this choice altogether, there's a better approach to difficulty settings that too many developers are ignoring. Dynamic difficulty appeals to all players. Dynamic difficulty adjustment is a form of game balancing that enables a game to automatically increase or lower its difficulty based on the player's performance. This means that playing better will cause the game to become more challenging. Likewise, dynamic difficulty allows a game to tone down its challenge if you're struggling to progress. By using dynamic difficulty, games are able to adapt to a player's skill level, creating experiences that are accessible to casual gamers and challenging for a hardcore audience. Whereas many games are criticized for being either too easy or too unforgiving, dynamic difficulty provides a way for everyone to enjoy the same title regardless of whether they're looking for tough-as-nails tests or a cozy game to relax with. So obviously this is long as shit.
Some of the dynamics are good and some of them aren't. It just depends.
Let's see. So basically it says, despite only a small number of releases, dynamic difficulty adjustment has played a significant role in shaping some of the best video games of all time. One of the most famous examples of dynamic difficulty can be found in Resident Evil 4. The game features a hidden scoring system that is constantly increasing and decreasing based on your performance in combat. This score will prompt the game to alternate between a difficulty scale that ranges from 1 to 10, with 1 being the easiest and 10 the hardest. A standard playthrough begins at rank 6, however, as you increase this difficulty by successfully killing enemies and avoiding attacks, your foes become tougher, act more aggressively, and appear in larger numbers. Similarly, missing shots and repeatedly dying will lower your difficulty rank. Resident Evil 4 also demonstrates how dynamic difficulty and traditional difficulty settings aren't mutually exclusive. Along with the standard difficulty option, all versions of the game include an unlockable professional mode that locks the difficulty at rank 10. Later ports introduced easy mode, which features a more forgiving version of the dynamic difficulty system that climbs ranks at a slower rate. Since the release of Resident Evil 4, nearly every Resident Evil game has used a variant of this adaptive difficulty scale, including the title's 2023 remake. Wow, I didn't know that. Dynamic difficulty isn't always a hidden feature. Clover Studios' God Hand, oh, need to bring that back, transforms dynamic difficulty into a brutal risk-reward mechanic. Throughout the cult classic beat-em-up, you manage an always visible difficulty gauge, which will level up to the next difficulty rank when filled. Much like the dynamic difficulty of Resident Evil 4, God Hand's difficulty ranking rises and falls based on your performance in combat, moving on a scale that ranges from level 1 to a 4th rank called level Die. However, God Hand doesn't use this difficulty to make you comfortable. The game rewards you with better rewards for defeating enemies at higher levels, which might encourage you to reach level Die whenever possible. The catch is that God Hand is often considered to be one of the hardest games of all time. I didn't know that. And even the lower levels will provide a punishing reminder of its reputation. If the challenge ever becomes too much, you can grovel at your enemy's feet to drop the difficulty. As with Resident Evil 4, God Hand features two other difficulty options, an easy mode that removes the third and fourth levels, and a hard mode, which permanently locks the difficulty gauge at level Die. While these mechanics are usually tailored to single-player experiences, Left 4 Dead and its sequel utilize a dynamic difficulty system that can adapt to a four-player team. Rather than determining your skill based on a simple ranking system, Left 4 Dead's dynamic difficulty is carried out by the director, an artificial intelligence that spawns items and enemies based on your team's performance. If your team's low on health, the director will provide more items and throw out smaller hordes of zombies. However, if you're breezing through the level, it will respond with scarcer supplies and fiercer foes. Despite its absence in most modern releases, dynamic difficulty has continued to improve thanks to developers finding new and exciting ways for games to adapt around players. Metal Gear Solid V: The Phantom Pain features a unique dynamic difficulty system that doesn't always make the game tougher, but constantly forces you to adopt new strategies. When you rely too much on long-range headshots, enemy soldiers will begin wearing helmets and setting up snipers. If you prefer confronting these guards head-on, they'll eventually come prepared with shotguns and riot shields. Even the in-game time of day matters, as completing missions at night will lead to enemies equipping flashlights and night vision goggles. Metal Gear Solid 5 is remarkable for the countless options you have for completing objectives, but its creative approach to dynamic difficulty ensures that you can never depend on a single tactic for too long. Similar games often give you plenty of tools with little reason to use them, but Metal Gear Solid 5 cleverly uses its dynamic difficulty to encourage variety and experimentation in a way that few other games can match. So, let's see. Yeah, despite its proven effectiveness, many games still neglect dynamic difficulty adjustment in flavor of a traditional difficulty settings, or none at all. While this might sound like a problem, there's a few reasons why most game devs are sticking with these old-school methods. Some games are arguably worse because of the dynamic difficulty. Max Payne will gradually lower your health and worsen your aim as the game progresses, unless you die repeatedly in a short period of time. This ends up feeling like punishment for playing well and makes your guns woefully unreliable during later levels unless you exploit the dynamic difficulty by intentionally dying. In The Elder Scrolls IV, it's another example of poorly designed dynamic difficulty, though for very different reasons. Rather than weakening the player, Oblivion introduced level scaling, a mechanic that strengthens NPCs and introduces tougher creatures as you level up. Although that sounds like a decent idea and would later be perfected in Skyrim, Oblivion's steep difficulty curve discourages you from leveling or forming a character build that isn't strictly focused on combat. This unintended restriction works against the freedom of the game's open world design and often results in players restarting a playthrough rather than adapting to the challenge. Even multiplayer games aren't safe from bad dynamic difficulty. Mario Kart 8 determines which items you can receive from an item box based on your current placement in the race. If you're lagging behind or falling to last place, you'll get better items than the racers in the lead.
That kind of sounds shitty.
Yeah. However, many players exploit this mechanic by deliberately staying in last place before using the game's best items during the final lap to enter first place at the last second. Thankfully, this problem was eventually addressed in a later patch. Aside from the ways dynamic difficulty can detract from a game, there's no denying that implementing preset standard difficulty options is easier and sometimes more effective. Popular action series like Halo and Call of Duty provide players with a small selection of static difficulty settings. While these options won't be as carefully tuned to your preferences as the dynamic difficulty system, they still succeed in captivating both hardcore and casual players. Compare that with RE4, which required the developers of Capcom to design and playtest 10 different difficulty settings, as well as program a dynamic system that evaluates player performance and subtly tweaks the game's balancing. All this needs to be implemented without the player ever noticing or creating an opportunity for them to exploit the mechanic. Dynamic difficulty is already complicated, and it's a miracle when it actually works. Although it's incredibly impressive when a game pulls off dynamic difficulty, I don't blame other devs for sticking with static difficulty options. And now the guy's like, dynamic difficulty is still the best. Even with its faults, dynamic difficulty adjustment is still one of the best ways to handle video game difficulty. When it works as intended, dynamic difficulty fine-tunes a game to fit your taste, delivering experiences that fit the creator's vision without alienating players. No matter your skill level, dynamic difficulty allows any game to provide the perfect amount of challenge. It's also been used to ensure every playthrough feels different, bringing plenty of variety and infinite replayability to your favorite games. While it's clear why dynamic difficulty is still rarely seen in games, I'm hoping more devs will give it a chance in the future. Okay, that's interesting. US UK signed joint agreement to regulate internet harms. Washington, London, the US and UK have signed a joint agreement to coordinate efforts to regulate internet content, including adult content, in order to advance stronger protections for children. The agreement was announced in an official notice from the UK government. According to the statement, since the UK and US share fundamental values of a commitment to democracy and human rights, including privacy and freedom of expression, the countries intend to establish a joint children's online safety working group. To make the internet safer for children, the statement notes, the two nations will aim to ensure all users have the skills and resources.
Constantine 2 first look trailer.
Okay, we'll check it out in a minute. Although the UK is a constitutional monarchy with no written constitution, no absolute free speech legal tradition, or anything like First Amendment jurisprudence, and an unelected chamber of aristocrats in their parliament, the agreement and the UK government statement contend that the US and UK rights and practices can be considered compatible in order to enforce internet regulations of materials either or both governments consider harmful to children. The UK government statement declares that online platforms, including social media companies, have a moral responsibility to respect human rights and put in place additional protections for children's safety and privacy, and that age-appropriate safeguards, including protections from content and interactions that harm children's health and safety, are vital to achieve this goal. Among the content considered harmful, the UK government lists sexual exploitation and abuse, and content that is abusive, including technology facilitated gender-based violence. As XBiz reported, according to several anti-porn crusaders consulted by the UK government during the drafting of the Online Safety Act and the review of pornography laws currently underway and led by the Baroness Burton, however, all adult content would fall into either or both of those categories. By signing the joint agreement, the U.S. appears to endorse the U.K.'s controversial Online Safety Act, which mandates age verification. The OSA is mentioned by the U.K. government statement in the agreement, specifically noting that platforms must use highly effective privacy-preserving age assurance technologies to prevent children from encountering the most harmful content, including pornography, which includes violent pornography, and content which encourages or promotes suicide. Age verification of adult content has repeatedly been struck down as unconstitutional by U.S. courts. The issue is currently being reviewed by the Supreme Court in the landmark case FSC v. Paxton, which has not yet been decided. The U.S. domestic legislative proposal most analogous to the OSA is the Kids Online Safety Act, COSA, which is currently stuck in Congress after failing to move forward following several years of debates because of serious constitutional and privacy concerns. Washington Examiner's Pro Project 2025 op-ed calls adult content a spiritual epidemic. Washington Examiner published on Tuesday an op-ed by Christian Wright ideologue supporting Project 2025's proposal to criminalize the production and distribution of adult content and condemning pornography as a social, mental, and spiritual epidemic of high proportions. Titled Project 2025 Should Accept Its Pro-Pornography Critiques as a Badge of Honor, the article in the conservative newspaper was penned by Adam Carrington, a clergyman and assistant professor of politics at Ashland University in Ohio, where he also serves as co-director of influential conservative training institute, the Ashbrook Center. Carrington's virulently anti-porn op-ed ran as part of the Examiner's ultra-conservative propaganda series, Restoring America, which, despite this recent call for massive censorship, unironically lists among its objectives supporting policies that promote freedom and resist central control. Responding to the new performer-driven hashtag #HandsOffMyPorn campaign launched this week by industry figures to bring attention to Project 2025's extreme proposals, Carrington argues that Project 2025 and Heritage Foundation should view such opposition as a source of pride. Much more should be done legally and culturally to limit suppression, ostracize the making and consumption of pornography, Carrington writes, ignoring the multiple testimonials by #HandsOffMyPorn supporters that they are freely choosing their work, as he justifies his position on the grounds that adult content degrades the people involved regardless of why they participate or how they think about their participation. Everyone in the adult industry, the conservative academic continues, is destroying the link between the sexual act and the rest of our humanity. Pornography severs the relational link where sex expresses loving intimacy with the protective confines of stable, healthy marriages. Pornography destroys the procreative link whereby the act remains open to the creation of the next generation of human beings. Finally, it damages our link to God, disobeying his natural and revealed law that orders our lives for our physical, emotional, and spiritual health. Carrington expresses contempt for people who choose to watch adult content, theorizing pornography also degrades the person consuming it. They participate in the severed links described that plague participants in this industry. Severing sex from relationships also affects their real-life marriages and friendships and facilitates treating other human beings as objects and used for one's own selfish pleasure. Endorsing debunked pseudo-scientific notions, Carrington claims that pornography also addicts its watchers to cheap and ugly thrills, fueling fetishes and their ilk. Instead, he mandates we should be engaging with each other through the long-term commitment of monogamy. Carrington goes on to claim that pornography consumption makes friendship harder as well, for it accentuates the sexualization of everyone and everything. He concludes by asserting that adult content is a social, mental, and spiritual epidemic of high proportions before calling for the limiting and suppressing this malicious industry by the federal government. I mean, he's just, you know...
I mean, there's parts of it that are, you know, okay and tasteful, and there's parts of it that are... What is that?
Dog vision? Yeah.
I gotta look that one up. I already know that one's it's a Louis L'Amour. Not Louis L'Amour.
Oh, right.
Damn it. Can't think of his name, but it
French Court.
It's about the French Revolution.
Wow, the French Court is
Lady
just
Liberty
blocked.
Running, leading the troops into victory.
The Paris Court of Appeal has ordered 4 adult sites blocked in France if they fail to comply with age verification requirements within 15 days. Then we have what? The Hands Off My Porn campaign has doubled its ad buy in swing states ahead of next month's election.
I will say, if all you think about is porn and on porn.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably a problem mm-hmm. for you. It does. When everything you look at, you see through the eyes of porn.
The Hands Off My Porn campaign has doubled its ad buy in swing states. The campaign, initiated by a group of high-profile adult performance directors and content creators in collaboration with progressive political marketing group Artists United for Change, has announced it will spend another $100,000 on pre-roll and banner ads on adult websites, as well as pre-roll ads on mainstream sites. A handful of votes in a handful of states will determine who is our next president. We're confident that our campaign will be a difference maker, said content creator Allie Awesome, who stars in one of the ads. In a 900-page document, the authors put forth their total ban and criminalization of pornography on page 5. That's how serious they are about this, and voters need to know. Director Michael Vegas, who stars in another ad, says, "A former Republican who grew up in a swing state like Orange County, I'm exactly the target demographic of this ad campaign, and say it's highly effective. Young men who enjoy our product need to be aware that 2025 goes further than ever before, completely bans pornography and criminalizes it all. This will ultimately infringe on the constitutional rights of those who consume porn. It won't end with us." The campaign also noted the initial group of 17 industry names behind the campaign has swelled to 51. So, what exactly is going on here? Hands off
my porn. I do kind of think the more you restrict and it's harder to get a hold of.
Because it's an anti-Trump thing. So, they're basically saying Trump's allies want to use the full weight of the U.S. government to get rid of all pornography.
I think they're full of shit. Oh, they're trying with everything. Oh, they won't let you have abortions. Oh, they're going to take your porn. Like, really?
And shut down all porn sites. Well, there are a lot of jerk-offs in Washington, D.C., the ones on the right wing.
Well, the problem with internet porn is it's hard to regulate
for
kids getting a hold of. It's very easy for, oh, if you're 18, I'm not 18. I can't enter this. No, they just say enter. Yeah, I'm good.
Read what they're saying. Testimonial.
I would have to see who these are coming from, too.
Project 25 saying porn makes folks want to be transgender. Made me inform myself about what's happening in politics.
I hate to tell you, they're trying to push transgender porn all over the internet.
Yeah, right, that now is true. But they're trying to say that all porn in general is making people want to be transgender.
Really? I don't see how.
Does anyone really think America's going to stop watching adult content because Project 2025 wants to outlaw it? Oh, that's Seth Gamble. This will cause the market to shift in other countries, move jobs overseas.
I think you're going to see more sex trafficking and everything else.
American consumers use VPN to view from a foreign IP address. Let's not kill another industry that's proudly based in America.
Now, I will say probably a lot of the porn industry is already evil. I mean, there's a lot
of the old
from current porn actresses, not Lana Rhodes, that was like number one porn lookup from Pornhub and everything else. She has terrible stories about porn. She got out of it. Several people that are very famous in porn have gotten out of porn, and it's traumatized them. Because they are kind of, you can make more money, you can make a living and not have to be in this forever if you do this. And
right,
it just gradually gets worse and worse and worse, things you have to agree to sometimes.
I don't know. It depends.
I mean, and some people...
Right. I think it's different for different people.
And a lot of them, too, where I've heard actresses getting their start, they usually do come from broken homes, and that's a lot of times how they catch predators, is posing as kids from broken homes.
So. Their main argument is that porn will make folks transgender. They zealots think that pornography manifested today is the omnipresent propagation of transgender ideology, and sexualization of children, for instance, is not a political Gordian knot inextricably binding up disparate claims about free speech, property rights, sexual liberation, and child welfare. They believe they're saving society. They clearly state that pornography's purveyors are child predators and misogynistic exploiters of women. Women in the adult industry are not victims. They're businesswomen who enjoy their jobs, enjoy full autonomy over their bodies, and have built powerful brands.
There are some.
Their product is as addictive as any illicit drug and psychologically destructive as any crime. Pornography should be outlawed. They want to criminalize porn, make folks register as sex offenders, and shut down all porn sites.
Now, I think they need better regulations on how operators operate.
They're working on that.
But
they've been working on that.
My pleasure to become anyone's pain.
Right, absolutely. I agree with you. And there's a lot of, it's changed a lot. You may have heard from one person that was good on Pornhub, but there's a lot of regulations that they've been doing.
I've explored the world of
Well, I know, but I'm talking about the
industry. I'm doing my research.
Yes, but the industry itself.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been working
into the industry, too.
I mean, some
of the videos I would watch were women snapping, having a fucking psychotic attack because they realize
what
they've degraded themselves to.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends.
While in a porn. Like, get the fuck off me! Get the fuck off me! And dude's like laughing because he's like, oh, she's playing her. No, she's fucking serious. I'm gonna rip your dick off. Like, fucking, oh, it's crazy.
Well, J.D. Vance has stated his right-wing positions and desire to ban porn clearly from his earliest days in office.
Yeah. We'll see.
Tell them to keep their hands off my porn, register, and vote. Ironically, and the weaponization...
Honestly, that sounds like a Kamala... we've lost everywhere
else.
Every time Kamala opens her mouth, they lose voters. Like, what can we do to turn this around? Tell them they're going to take their porn if they get in the office.
Oh, okay. Of course it's going to be MSNBC. But
yeah. Well, that tells you a lot. You cannot trust.
No, you really can't.
Everything, because I will watch, and even Fox News, you really have to look over everything.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Even though they're more right-leaning, I still double-check, you know. Like, I'll watch some MSNBC just to see what the other side's saying. Then I'll compare it to video footage I've seen. Then of course, I follow some independent reporters.
Yeah, there's a lot. But all right, so now we got something a little different. Oh, this is short. Who are the Japanese? New DNA evidence emerges from 2,000-year-old genome.
Cool.
Genetic analysis of an individual from the Yaoi period reveals immigration patterns from the Korean Peninsula. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have revealed that the primary influx of immigrants from the Japanese archipelago during the Yayoi and Kofun periods primarily originated from the Korean Peninsula. This discovery, based on genome analysis of ancient individuals, challenges previous admixture models and refines our understanding of Japanese ancestry. A research team led by Jong-Yoon Kim and Jun Ohashi from the University of Tokyo has found that during the Yayoi and Kofun periods, the majority of immigrants of the Japanese archipelago came from the Korean Peninsula. Their study analyzed that the complete genome of a Yayoi individual and found that among the non-Japanese populations, the results showed the genetic makeup most closely resembled that of Korean populations. Although it is widely accepted that modern Japanese populations have a dual ancestry, the discovery provides insight into the details of immigration patterns to the archipelago that had previously puzzled researchers. The findings were published today, October 14th, in the Journal of Human Genetics. Today, Japan is an international hub for both business and pleasure. However, this was not always the case. The Japanese archipelago was relatively isolated during the Jomon period until around 3000 BCE. Then, during the Yayoi and Kofun periods, immigration to the islands from continental Asia began. Northeast Asian-related ancestries account for over 80% of nuclear genomes of the modern Japanese population, explains Ohashi, the principal investigator of the study. However, how the Japanese population acquired these genetic ancestries, that is, the origins of the immigration, is not fully understood. Various theories have been proposed to explain the genetic variety in the modern population. Currently, the two contenders are the two-way and three-way admixture models. According to the two-way model, the main source of immigration was the same during the Yayoi and Kofun periods, while the three-way model assumes two different sources. To investigate which model was the better fit, the researchers analyzed the complete nuclear genome of an individual from the Doigama site, Doigahama site, an archaeological site of Yayoi period cemetery in Yamaguchi Prefecture, Japan. The researchers compared the genome of this Yayoi period individual with this genome of ancient and modern populations in East Asia and Northeast Asia. The comparison showed close similarity to Kofun period individuals with distinct Jomon-related, East Asian-related, and Northeast Asian-related ancestries. However, a comparison with modern genomes also revealed that The Yayoi individual, except for modern Japanese populations, was the closest to modern Korean populations, which also have both East Asian-related and Northeast Asian-related ancestries. Our results suggest that between the Yayoi and Kofun periods, the majority of immigrants in the Japanese archipelago originated primarily from the Korean peninsula, says Ohashi. The results also mean that the three-way admixture model, which posits that a Northeast Asian group migrated to the Japanese archipelago during the Yayoi period and an East Asian group during the Kofun period, is incorrect. Despite the significance of these findings, Ohashi is already looking ahead. Since our study has identified the primary origins of the immigrants, our next goal is to examine the genomes of more Yayoi individuals to clarify why more than 80% of the genomic components of the modern Japanese population are derived from immigration and how the admixture between continental Asian and indigenous Jomon people progressed within the Japanese archipelago. Okay, so there you go, guys. It seems that they're Korean.
Partly.
Well, primarily from the Korean peninsula.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting anyway. Okay, how Terrifier 3... Okay, Terrifier 3, not clowning around. How the uber-gruesome pick upended the movie rating system. For decades, most cinemas refused to play a movie that was unrated. Terrifier 3 was too tempting to pass up. In a history-making move, the uber-gruesome indie slasher pick Terrifier 3 took out a Hollywood institution in one fell swoop. The movie rating system. Filmmaker Damien Leone... We'll read this afterwards. Filmmaker Damien Leone's threequel stunned the town when opening to $18.9 million over the October 11th to 13th weekend, despite being unrated. Before the pandemic, few movie theaters would book a title that didn't have a rating because of strict limits on TV advertising, among other things. But times have changed, and Terrifier 3 was able to secure a berth in 2,513 cinemas. Wow. Now, it is on its way to becoming the top grossing unrated film of all time domestically against a minuscule budget of $2 million and barely any marketing spend on the part of Chris McGurk's Cineverse Corp, which released the movie. Between COVID and the historic 2023 labor strikes, the box office calendar is still at an agitated state of flux, and most exhibitors weren't going to refuse to play what they knew was a sure bet, particularly after Joker Folie à Deux crashed and burned a week prior. Terrifier 3 was the movie fanboys wanted Joker to be, says one top studio marketer of the films, which both center on villainous clowns. It's also the second unrated film to open to number one after Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, which debuted to $21.8 million in early December 2023 on its way to topping out $33.9 million domestically. It didn't have time to go through the ratings process, but it was a concert doc, and people, particularly parents, knew what to expect. Terrifier 3 had plenty of time, but it didn't even try to get a rating, meaning it didn't have to comply with any rules laid out by the Classification and Rating Administration, which administers a voluntary rating system on behalf of the Motion Picture Association and the National Association of Theater Owners. And had it been submitted, it risked receiving an NC-17 rating, meaning that no one 17 or younger could buy a ticket, period. The Hollywood Reporter has learned that theaters carrying the film, including the three biggest circuits, are treating Terrifier 3 as if it were R-rated, and trying to turn away anyone who is 17 or younger if they aren't accompanied by a parent or guardian. Two distribution sources noted over the weekend that DreamWorks Animation Universal's The Wild Robot saw a noticeable bump, and speculate that teenagers and tweens bought tickets to that film and sneaked into Terrifier 3.
I have heard good things about that robot film from, I think, Stephen Crowder.
Maybe you'll get to see it for yourself soon.
Yeah.
The same trend continued on Monday's Indigenous Peoples Day holiday. I forgot about that. The scary part is that we've seen a lot of screenshots of people bringing their kids to the movie, notes another source of the film, which pushes the boundaries to excess, including starting off with a child being murdered off screen in a scene of genital mutilation.
Oh boy.
These kids are used to everything now, though.
Yeah.
The four major Hollywood movie studios, Disney, Paramount, Sony, and Warner Brothers, could never pull off what Cineverse accomplished. As members of the MPA, they must submit their films to the ratings board. Amazon, MGM Studios, and Netflix are also members. If a film is submitted to DCARA, but ultimately decides to go out unrated, it still has to adhere to CARA's advertising rules, which prohibit a broadcaster from carrying an ad for an unrated film and limit trailer play. In the early 2000s, Hollywood studios and the voluntary rating system were called out by Congress after a blistering report issued by the Federal Trade Commission concluded that some studios were actively promoting R-rated films to youngsters. Well, I mean, Terminator, Alien, a lot of shit. Yeah. No, early on. This is early on. This is 90s.
Well, yeah, they all had action figures.
Yeah.
Alien.
Yeah.
Predator.
Yep. The NPA chief Jack Valenti, alongside NATO, updated the rating system as a way of appeasing lawmakers, including providing additional descriptors as RoboCop as to why a movie received the rating it did. The marketing rules were also tightened. Cineverse is primarily a digital marketing and brand content venture. It has more than 30 streaming channels that attract 80 million monthly viewers. McGurk, a Hollywood studio vet, says the company is now upping its theatrical presence. He says only $500,000 was spent to market Terrifier 3 because of the company's vast footprint in the horror space, including Bloody Disgusting, a go-to website for horror fanatics. On top of its streaming channel, Cineverse has a network of 40 podcasts. Okay, I mean, that's cool. McGurk estimates that he has been involved in the release of 500 films, but says he's never seen anything like this. I've never had a movie where the actual out-of-pocket marketing spend to box office has been this ratio. It's off the charts, he says, crediting the success to a different approach to finding an audience and leveraging everything except national media. The ultra-low-budget first Terrifier did not get a theatrical launch, but 2002's Terrifier 2 did. However, it debuted in far fewer locations than the threequel, or 770 cinemas, and many locations only provided one showtime in the evening and refused to play it on Sundays. McGurk said he expected the $250,000 budgeted Terrifier 2 to be a one-weekend event, then go quickly to digital, but its run was extended based on demand. It ultimately played more than 1,500 theaters and grossed $10 million domestically, which more than justified the heftier $2 million budget for the threequel. We didn't have a problem getting the screens this time, he said. Exhibitors knew the film was going to do business based on advanced ticket sales, social media trends, and tracking. We knew it was going to do well, but we didn't imagine it was going to do this, he adds. You're dealing with an unknown animal because people hadn't seen an unrated movie tracking like this. The exec believes Terrifier 3, set at Christmas, will play through the year-end holiday and is plotting a special Christmas Eve event.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That'll be around for a while.
The film ends on a cliffhanger, and filmmaker Leone has spoken about wanting to keep the franchise going. Also, a couple other things. I've been watching a lot about Leone. First of all, he isn't throwing away... He actually stands by a review that stated that the film had some religious undertones. Yeah. He said, oh, somebody finally got it. You have to really, really look. And people that were Catholic could see what was going on. Yeah. It's not the clown.
I had it.
It's there. It's there and it's purposeful.
Now, do you know what all that was?
Yes.
I mean, I can see Christian undertones. But
No. We're not talking about that.
Well, you know, the Catholicism.
There's Catholicism. Yeah, I know that. But the Catholicism is really hardcore in this film. There's even the, what is it, where she kills the snake, stomps on the snake with her foot. That's symbolic of a saint in Catholicism.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that has been done.
Well, that was in Genesis, too. Women will have pains. You know, the serpent and the enemies of each other. They'll bite the heel and...
I'll find the review, but Damien Leone actually posted on Twitter. He highly supports this review. And by the way, he's only going to do like a few more Terrifiers, but he says that the only reason he's doing the Terrifier movies like he was with an independent is because of the kind of films they are. But he said personally he's willing to work with Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, yeah.
He does want to work with big studios. He doesn't want the Terrifier films to be known as gore fest. He says there's definitely a story, and he definitely tried to work with that. The gore is part of it, but it's not the main point.
They had a movie with Art the Clown before the first one.
I know, I saw it.
I just didn't care for it.
I liked it.
Did you?
I actually thought it was scarier than 3.
Really? I might have to rewatch it, but it just
I
did not
thought
do
it was, and I want the alien to come back. I've let everybody on Earth know I want that alien back because there's so much I could do with that alien.
Yeah, I bet.
I was just thinking, you know, I hadn't mentioned anything because, you know, Damon Leone, follow him on Twitter. But yeah, it's like, if you ever want to bring this alien back, I'm your guy. I can come up with a really good script.
Yeah, it's been about a year since I've seen it. I'll probably have to rewatch it, but I don't remember a lot except I, compared to 1, I did not care for it.
Oh, I loved it. I liked it better than 1.
1 I liked.
I didn't like 1 so much. I liked him so much better in All Hallows Eve. I thought it was just so much better. McGurk, who decided to comment on any plans for a decline to comment, even though they are going to do it. He said, oh yeah, and they're definitely ready to get work on it. So don't worry about what this idiot said. I know what's going on. Alright, so basically we're going to look at this real quick and then flip back. James Gunn, he basically said, what is he saying here? Superman. Crypto, that's something that's been amazing. We've been working with him in the edit. He's an incredible part of the story to me personally. They're giving Superman his dog back. When I was writing the screenplay, he came in and kind of changed everything up. We're deep in the process of editing. David Corenswet is going to fucking blow people away. I really hope this guy is going to be better than than Henry Cavill. I think he might even be a better Superman.
We'll see.
He is the movie star that everyone just dreams he could possibly be. I don't think anyone really understands just the depths of this guy's talent dramatically, comedically. He's the best physical action star I've probably ever worked with. Gunn said before being jokingly cut off by another panelist, I feel good about it, and I'm really hard on stuff, so it's been fantastic. It won't be long before we see a trailer, but it also won't be too soon. So they're doing the Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow.
Oh,
they're doing Lantern.
Supergirl.
They're doing it based on, what did they say? Oh! I'm not going to say anything, but wow. Holy crap. Holy crapola.
Right.
There's so much I want to say, but I can't say it.
Why not?
I can't say it.
Why?
I just can't.
Say you can't.
I want to say it. I like there's like, oh my god, I can't believe what I've just read, but I can't say it.
Maybe you should leave it on there so I can read.
No, it doesn't have anything to do with that. I'll tell you off the show. That's something I don't want. But it's cool. It's very cool. I'm okay. So anyway, Smile did $23 million opening, so it just beat Smile Terrifier.
Pit. Yeah, it did look good. We saw the previews.
You might get to see for yourself.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, what's the next one? Did kids sneak into the Terrifier via the wild robot? Yeah. Sneaking in, yeah, it's a sneaking into a movie is a time-honored tradition, one that must be as old as cinema itself. It continues with the unrated Terrifier 3. And, it said, according to distribution sources for The Hollywood Reporter, the family-friendly DreamWorks animation picture The Wild Robot saw what's described as a noticeable bump over the long weekend. Distributors theorized that kids were buying robot tickets to sneak into Terrifier.
Yeah. You think about it. When's the last, even when we went and saw the movie the other night,
right?
How many other workers
yeah.
you saw going around making sure people went into the movie they were supposed
right.
to go in? Not any.
I'm giving dating apps another try as a single mom. Men interested in open relationships are a green flag. Got this one from Drex.
A green flag or
the
a red
first
flag?
Time I dated a non-monogamous man was in 2012. That lasted a year and a half until I met someone else and transitioned into a more traditional monogamous relationship that lasted 5 years. In hindsight, the earlier relationship was undoubtedly the healthiest I've ever experienced. Contrary to what some people assume about non-monogamy, it's not just about sex. I've found that open relationships only work if they're based on complete trust, honesty, and great communication. Those are all key qualities I want in a partner. So when I recently opted to give dating apps another try, I decided to actively look out for non-monogamy when scrolling through online dating profiles. They've been easy to find, as 2 years ago, Hinge, the app I'm trying out this time around, added a feature that allows users to designate their relationship type on their profile. The choices include monogamous, non-monogamous, or figuring out my relationship type. Men who state their preferred relationship type is non-monogamous probably drive away a lot of women, but I see it as brave and uncompromising that they choose to write it anyway. Basically, they don't just tell you what they think you want to hear. When I see non-monogamy, as long as the profile has their actual photo and they're not hiding behind anything, I'm confident I'm going to meet someone who's transparent. For the ones with partners, I found that not only is she aware he's on dating apps, but she's usually dating around as well. I'm not interested in profiles that list multiple options. Reading between the lines, to me, it just means I'm playing the field, so don't hold me to anything. They also seem to be the ones who are probably not okay with you being with other people. One such man, who'd been divorced for over 10 years, asked me what my dating life had been like in the 5 years I'd been single. I replied truthfully that I'd rekindled a few old relationships and explored some long-standing friendships. His response was, "How will it work with all of these men around?" It made me wonder what he would have said if I had shared less than just told him that I'd been figuring out my relationship type for 5 years. Someone who selects only non-monogamy has usually made some very well thought out and difficult choices about how they want to live their life. It takes guts to be transparent and honest about that despite it narrowing the dating pool significantly. They're better communicators. I found these men to be open about their feelings and intentions across the board. They know that trust isn't limited to sexual fidelity. It's about making someone feel secure, airing problems before they blow up, and following up words with actions. They're also good at communicating plans, which I've found rare in the dating world, where I often don't know when or if a guy wants to see me again. With my partner in 2012, we plan our next date at the end of every date. I always felt valued and secure. Juggling multiple people means having to be really good at time management, so concrete plans are important. But I see it as more than just being on top of their diary. It feels like non-monogamous men I've dated place a high value on relationships. They've learned that you can't let things go stale or silent if you want to share something special. That's right, I said special, not unique, which isn't at all the same thing. It's not just about sex. I found that non-monogamous men have an abundance mindset when it comes to sex, not a scarcity mindset. They don't need to hoard it, chase it, or pressure it. For monogamous men, you're the only one who can supply what they want unless they cheat, so there's more chance of scarcity and therefore pressure. I tested this out on a couple of first dates recently, one with a non-monogamous man and another with a monogamy, figuring out my relationship style profile. During the evening, I told them both that, in the last 5 years, my average length of time before sleeping with it's getting close, guys, yep, has been 12 years. The monogamous man physically recoiled. He actually took a step back. "I haven't got 12 years, love," he said. His overall air was somewhat offended. He disappeared quickly. The non-monogamous guy, he got it straight away. "Ah, it's all about trust," he said. "Exactly, I felt so heard." The conversation then naturally moved on to other topics. No big deal. The second time we met up, I asked him about his reaction. "You were describing how it has been," he said, showing once again how he was able to hear what I said instead of a threat to his likelihood of sex. A third date is on the cards.
You notice how he said, "I don't have 12 years." That kind of sounds like how women in their 30s used
right.
to be.
"So far, I've never actually been in an open relationship. I've only dated men who were non-monogamous while I've been single. But they've certainly taught me to expect much more than just bringing monogamy to a relationship." To each their own, to each their own. Alright. Let's see. Women have a new reason why they refuse to split the bill on dates. It all adds up. Women on social media are debating over the hidden fees associated with getting prepared for dates. One New York City-based TikToker explained that she refuses to split the bill on a date because she's actually splitting the bill before she even gets to the date. Regardless of the cost of the check at the end of the date, I'm spending money to show up, Nancy shared.
What is the guy doing? They're spending the amount of money to show up, too.
The user explained that as soon as she has a date scheduled, she books a cycle bar class, $38. $38, her eyebrows done, $38 plus $10 tip.
Oh, you got to put on your disguise, is what you're saying.
$75 to $10 tip. That's a total of $171. She also listed the cost of all her goddamn beauty and hair products she used while getting ready, which cost a total of $223.49.
That sounds including like the same thing we've been covering for
$6.49 curl cream, $22 concealer, $52 blush, $36 bronzer, $32 highlighter, $14 eyeliner. $35 mascara and $26 lip gloss and Highlander, why not? Fucking, yeah. You could be only one with all these goddamn.
So you take it all off at the end of the night and the guy's like, fuck!
I mean, look at all that shit. Look at all that shit.
Yeah. I just showed up in like this werewolf costume sent me back $400? So I do think I've covered my half of going Dutch.
So you covered the meal, we'll
call it even. I even practiced my howl before the date so I'd look authentic.
She continued to say that even if she already did her brows or manicure earlier in the week, it takes her a whole day to get ready. She has to plan her outfit, plan her hair wash schedule, and be mindful about what she eats before the date.
So it takes you a full day to look pretty?
I love garlic knots. I'm not having garlic knots to pregame, she joked.
Garlic
and then a guy knots. Is gonna ask you to split the bill on a date when he won't even split the conversation, she said. I spent all this time and money to get to the date. I'm not leaving my credit card out once I'm there.
I will tell you, I've noticed this lately, is women are more and more wanting the guy to hold up the whole conversation, it seems like.
Right. And I mean, like, I can do that, shit. But
there's one.
But I feel bad,
messaging
like,
back and forth, and the woman's giving like yes or no answers, and he's finally like, he's like, "Do you lift weights?" And she's like, "No." I'm like, "Well, you need to start. I can't carry this conversation all by myself."
Yeah, exactly. Hey, that's true. I mean, I can talk to my eyes fall out of my head, but the thing is, I feel like I feel bad a little bit because I'm like, well, aren't you supposed to say something?
Honestly, I want to be able to talk to a woman like I could a friend,
right?
Because friends has got it figured out,
right?
I mean, there's no pressure.
Well,
you're not, and of course, you're not trying to fuck the friend,
right? While many people online agreed that a woman shouldn't split the bill on the first date, they didn't think that the cost of getting ready was a fair reasoning. And podcast host Kimberly Merstein echoed that, rather. "I'd be offended if a man didn't offer to pay for the first date, but not specifically because of all the beauty treatments I got," the Palm Beach and NYC-based creator told Daily Mail. Merstein, who co-hosts the podcast Excuse My Grandma, where she talks about dating with her grandma, Gail, says she gets manicures regularly, but she also does schedule a mani-pedi right before a date, as well as a blowout when she starts dating someone, which is usually between $60 to $80 on Glam Squad. Later on in, darling, you start thinking about things like waxing or laser appointments too, so it all ends up.
But they were going to do that anyway, because
right,
women spend a lot on their hair appointments.
Meanwhile, Gail has been married for more than 60 years and has more low-key date nights with her husband, where she usually goes for a sweater and pants and doesn't feel the need to try as hard, but glam is still important. "Don't get it twisted, she'll always have her hair blown out, date night or not," Merstein laughed, speaking of her grandma. "I do think it takes me longer to get ready than it does for a guy, and that should be acknowledged with a compliment of some sort," she said. "But mostly I stand with my grandma on the principle that a guy should take care of the first date." Though Merstein never wants to split the bill, she always does the reach, going for a wallet and acting like she'll pay. Of course, after the first few dates, it's up to the couple to figure out how they want to handle finances going forward, she said.
I can't stand the reach for the purse yet.
Meanwhile, a financial empowerment expert also agreed that the man should be the one paying on a date. Call me old-fashioned, but I don't think a woman should split the bill under any circumstances, Amanda Francis, who offers digital courses to focus on sharing investment advice with women, told the Daily Mail. The financial empowerment expert based in Newport Beach, California, has been in a relationship for a few years, but when she was single, she believed that even though she could take care of herself and made money, there was just something about the type of man who would never let you pay for dinner. Yeah. Francis also noted that while beauty and exercise are important for yourself, it shouldn't be done specifically for the men you're going on dates with. If doing some sort of treatment puts you in a calm and confident state for a date, then definitely do that for yourself, but he should be paying regardless, she said. I don't think we should be doing any skincare treatments or procedures for men, but we absolutely should be doing them for ourselves. If your rent mortgage is paid, you've met her savings and investment goals for the month, then by all means, do all the beauty treatments you desire, she advised. Personally, my weekly blowout, in-home mani-pedi, and monthly facial are non-negotiable.
Well, that's on your own time, bitch. I'll put it to you this way. I've never had a woman pay on a date. If I'm asking them out, I'm covering the cost. But in the instance I'm a traditional guy, I expect to be taken out at least a traditional girl or someone with traditional values. They can't say, well, it's tradition for a guy to pay, and then they go out with you and then go sleep with every other guy in town. I'm traditional. I'm a whore on the streets and a freak in the street.
Well, I'll be damned. We got this real quick one. Ex-FDA food expert reveals worst cereal in America with link to cancer. Worst wanted cereal killer? An ex-FDA employee has revealed what he claims is the most harmful breakfast cereal on the market.
Oh, wow.
Dr. Darren Detwiller, who previously served as a food safety expert for the agency, told the Daily Mail that Kellogg's Fruit Loops is the worst of the bunch, pointing out that the rainbow rings are heavily processed and contain high levels of added sugars, artificial dyes, and preservatives, which are linked to health concerns.
Yeah, dyes have been linked to cancer.
A one-cup serving of Fruit Loops contains 12.35 grams of sugar. Good gravy.
Well, you know, a Coke or any kind of soda contains way more than that.
Oh, I know that. I'm good.
I had a Fanta the other day, and I looked, and it had like 27 grams of sugar in it.
Not a lot.
Like, I didn't know it wouldn't just be kind of wet sugar at that point.
Pretty much.
Like, no, it's not even... It's a solid with 27 grams of sugar. Technically.
Kellogg said they were going to remove all that shit by the end of 2018.
You know, they say all the pesticides they put on everything these days, at almost any cereal you get, is going to contain a certain amount of pesticides.
Oh,
within
I know.
Which
anything.
Is also not good for you.
I know. Well, you know, you just got to...
If
it's
killing
struggle.
Everything, what do you think it's doing to your body?
It's a struggle. It's a struggle. So,
I've never had Roundup on me.
What experts warn that a mysterious Rebecca syndrome is on the rise. So, are you a victim?
What the
fuck? Oh, listen up. Listen up. This is an exclusive. Coming across pictures of your partner with an ex in their arms or on a romantic getaway on social media is an all-too-easy problem in the world of modern dating. But experts claim it could be fueling a problem called Rebecca syndrome, with experts saying they have seen a rise in inquiries about the little-known condition. Also called retroactive jealousy, Rebecca syndrome refers to normal feelings of jealousy, but about things that occurred in the past, specifically your partner's previous sexual and romantic relationships. Sufferers may compare themselves to their partner's ex and believe this past lover is better looking, smarter, or even better in bed. Although you may have never heard of Rebecca syndrome, you may know the gothic novel that it's named after. So, basically, authored by Daphne De Maurier, in 1938, Rebecca follows a young woman who marries a wealthy man. But after moving into his home, she finds herself unable to cope, as the household and local community are still devoted to his late first wife, Rebecca. Dr. Darian Leder, a psychoanalyst and founding member of the Center for Freudian Analysis and Research in London, took inspiration from the novel and coined the term Rebecca syndrome to refer to retroactive jealousy. But this syndrome is not just a work of fiction, with many people admitting to being plagued by these illogical emotions. Psychotherapist Toby Ingham who has written about the condition, admits he's had an increasing amount of people inquiring about Rebecca syndrome since 2018. Mr. Ingram believes that the rise in inquiries is due to people Googling and self-diagnosing their obsessional problem, which he stresses is not a good idea. However, he explained that rather than being caused by relationships directly, retroactive jealousy often has its roots in childhood. While these early problems will be unique to each of us, they may, for example, relate to our having felt overlooked by a parent who preferred one of our siblings to us, he told Mail Online. Or perhaps the problem is feeling we were unimportant or excluded in our birth family. The problem is that we tend to lose sight of those early experiences and instead we project the issues onto our present relationship. This can leave people vulnerable to feeling as though they are being pushed out or excluded again when it is often the case that they're not. We become too caught up in our projections to recognize the difference, he explained. Our systematic review in 2017 of 230 studies on romantic jealousy found it was often rooted in low self-esteem and past experiences of infidelity. Studies suggest jealousy in a relationship is relatively common. Research in a 2017 study on married couples and relationship counseling found that 79% of men and 66% of women confessed to being jealous. While not a problem in itself, it can potentially trigger relationship issues.
Oh, those riggers.
But there's good news if you suspect you might be suffering from Rebecca syndrome, with Mr. Ingram saying there are a few ways to tackle it. Ask yourself whether your anxiety, your intrusive thoughts, I even get those, they suck, about feeling less important to your partner than their former partner may really relate to your own past rather than it being anything to do with your current relationship, he said. He also stresses the importance of refraining from scrolling through your partner's old social media feed, as this can just unleash Pandora's box. Don't fucking do it, ladies and gentlemen. Gentlemen too, don't fucking do it. While it may be tempting to look back on old pictures, including those with their ex, this will only exacerbate feelings of jealousy and make it easier to fall into negative thought patterns, he warned. Another 2018 interview-based study found social media may encourage retroactive jealousy, as you are more readily able to check details of your ex's past relationships. For the same reason, Mr. Ingham also urges people not to ask too many details about their partner's past that they may regret learning the answers to. That's true.
You don't want to know how many wieners have been in there before you have.
Don't ask about your partner's past, particularly their sexual histories, overshadowing at the start of new relationship often comes back to haunt us, he said.
Now, would you ever date a porn star that you found out she was a porn star after dating her for a while?
I don't know.
That'd be a tough one. But I would almost say possibly if her past was... Oh, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, it was a fan.
If the past was behind her and she wasn't doing that sort of... Maybe. I might have to have STD screening for her.
Right.
But, yeah. I don't know. That's a tough one to call, though. Of course, not jealousy, just that... you put more effort into being a top-notch man for someone that their younger years never tried being a top-notch woman for somebody.
Right. And that brings us to our last article. The others aren't that important. We can cover them later, but this one is. Help! My husband likes to get naked in front of my friends!
Why not?
Drifting round in the pool at our Tuscan villa is without doubt my happy place. Bought as a reward for a lot of hard work running a successful production company with my husband, George. I wonder if that's Lucas. It's the perfect place to unwind and host friends.
I'm going to whip out my starfighter. Oh, that lightsaber's getting a lot of action tonight. Around and around we go.
Most friends and family, except for one thing. George
Benjamin. Boy, that looks like a Wookiee right there. Oh, no.
It's tripping off. For while the views here include rolling hills, vineyards, and gorgeous medieval towns, they also feature my other half's bareback side.
If I was in Tuscany, one of the most romantic places in the world, I might be whipping my wiener out of here and there.
Over the years, I've cringed as I've seen every part of him bobbling about on a Lilo. I have to warn guests that those of a delicate disposition probably shouldn't come, because not only would George be naked, he'll encourage...
George's gonna be naked again.
He'll encourage them to go all natural, too. The first summer we had guests was a learning curve.
You know, in the beginning, Luke wasn't gonna kiss his sister, but I changed it.
One of my best friends had a crying fit after he greeted her at the front door in the nude.
A crying fit.
Afterwards... When she calmed down,
take it all in.
She wondered if he had early onset Alzheimer's, because Tuscan George was behaving so differently to London George, who was more of a striped pajamas sort of man. I explained that here he likes to leave not just the stresses and strains of the media world. This is definitely George Lucas.
Is he
worldwide, in but his inhibitions too.
I don't think he's in London or anything.
No, he's in Tuscany.
Well, yeah, there's where the villa is.
Right.
But they said different than London,
I don't
George.
Know. He says feeling the sun and breeze all over
London
him.
London George was proper, had tea at dawn.
Makes him feel a lightness he never experiences in the chaos of city life.
Oh, Tuscany.
I don't have to worry about my franchises being destroyed out here.
I can be free.
Right. Needless to say, I have tried to talk to George about wearing clothes.
It's no bigger than a swamp rat. Around, we used to whop those in the desert.
Around guests who might be offended. But he laughs it off, saying there are far worse things in the world than the odd bottom on display, and turns the tables on me for being too conventional. I've been called a prude more than I care to mention, when I'm really not. I just have an appreciation for what a gracious host should or shouldn't share with his host guests. Perhaps our friends might have been more forgiving of his behavior in his younger, fitter days. Doubtless in his mind, George is all... Hold on now. Doubtless in his mind, George is still all sinewy muscles and coppery tan. Yet now in his 60s, his reality is more an oily Ray Winstone.
Well, 60s? George Lucas is in his 70s at least.
Ironically, given the trouble it has caused, one of the things I've... I think he is in his 60s. Go look it up.
Okay.
I've always looked... one of the things I've always loved about George is how comfortable he is in his own skin. We met in the early 90s. I fell in love with his confidence, humor, and intelligence. I didn't realize likes to strip off in front of his friends in the sunshine would be a problem years down the line. With hindsight, I was warned, sort of on our first holiday, a last-minute deal to Ibiza, that George was keen to head to the nudist section of the beach.
He's 80.
Oh, wow. And was among the other young men who got naked in a nightclub foam party. By our late 30s, we'd done well enough to buy that Tuscan villa. George was in heaven, and the longer we spent over the years once our kids had grown up and left home, the fewer clothes he wore. He's always been complimentary about my body and encouraged me to ditch my caftan, too. In his defense, our home is private and secluded. There's no greater feeling than skinny dipping under the stars, and so why not when we're alone together? Now I'm approaching my 60s, and I'm far less keen than when I was in my 30s.
You know, the pasta there is the healthiest that you're going to get.
I'll bet it is.
Like, you can't get that in America.
Yeah.
Fucking everything's toxic in America.
But we had always intended to use our holiday home as a place for loved ones to stay, and that's when the trouble started. As well as shocked faces and comments about his sanity, I've lost friends over George's behavior. Before COVID, a girlfriend just out of divorce came to stay with us, but she just couldn't cope with George's ham, free and easy lifestyle. She retired to a room for most of the stay, and George didn't seem to notice. Well, George didn't notice. I certainly did. Driving her back to the airport, she let me have it, saying George's nakedness had ruined her holiday.
Well, you better cheer up or he's going to let you have it.
The last I saw of her was her flight taking off from the Pisa airport, and we've not spoken since.
Well, she needs to... If you get invited somewhere, I think surely she warned her ahead of time, if she's warning people.
None of our guests...
Thought you were joking when he said he'd be bare-ass naked.
None of our guests has seriously confronted him, though I put that down to politeness over us giving them a free holiday, and that these days I've given fair warning of what they're in for beforehand. Goodness knows what they say about us once they're home, though some have been happy enough to shed their own clothes. While it can be excruciatingly embarrassing, his cavalier attitude to nudity has never actually caused serious problems in our marriage. I know if I ever got truly distraught about it, he wouldn't be so dismissive. And though I know some people may assume otherwise, in 30 years of marriage, he's never been unfaithful or crossed the line with another woman. He's not a sexual predator, just a raging exhibitionist. He might seem like a relic from the Carry On films, but I really do love him.
Carry On.
And George is getting a lot bigger these days. It's actually quite difficult to see much beneath his tummy now. I should encourage him to think about weight loss, but his love of pasta is doing me and everyone else a favor.
Oh yeah, it's not great for you, but it is better than eating it from another point. It digests better.
Right. So, even though we want to talk about the sleeper train bunk bed was so narrow that missionary was our only option.
We'll save that for next time.
Alright guys, so this is the Grim Articles show, and we thank you for being part of this. I'm still kind of a little woozy from work, so you know. But it is what it is. But I'll see you guys in a minute with the games and a beer, and I'm out.
Later.
Enjoy the climb.